Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, welcome. I encourage you to go back and listen to some of our great guests that we've had over the last several years. And this week, we're going to look back at a conversation that we had with Byron Laughlin. He is the global head of NASDAQ Board Advisory and NASDAQ Center for Board Excellence. He has had a great career, and he's got some great lessons that he's going to share with you around leadership, and looking forward to today's conversation with Byron. Byron, can you first off give us just a little bit of your background and kind of an overview of your career?
Sure. Happy to do that. I started in politics. I worked in the congressional cycle of 83, 84 out of college, back when for the National Republican Congressional Committee for 2 years. I was really just looking for a job, and my congressman in Michigan happened to be a Republican. And back then, unlike today, there was great camaraderie between Republicans and Democrats, because sure. I ended up doing some work with actually Tip O'Neill and his crowd a bit back then. So my first indoctrination into leadership at that kind of level was working on consensus and working together and advancing the greater good. After that, I got involved in a leadership institute in DC that helped promote internships internationally that would place interns in places like offices on Capitol Hill and embassies. I did that for 5 years, and that was very rewarding as a young person. I did that in my mid-20s to build relationships with people from around the world that were coming to learn, and some of them from less developed countries, really coming to learn about our system of government and business. And then I spent 25 years in finance and in business, and ultimately ending that part of my career as the CEO of an investment and development and home building company that was sold in 2007 with no magic prior to the financial crisis and no magic, no crystal balls there. And then that, so I had a year, almost 2 years to kind of think about what I wanted to do next, but I knew it was in the area of leadership. And I had a hunch that it was in the area of working with boards at the higher level, because I had gone back to Harvard Business School to their 3-year executive program to learn more about leadership and leadership strategy. And that started the ball rolling in 2002 that led to me starting this company in 2010.
Great. So your interest in leadership, you've seen it in different different sectors on the government side as well as in business. But tell me a little bit more about kind of your motivation for starting the Center for Board Excellence.
Well, I believe that leaders, and I subscribe to the notion that leaders really want to move on an ongoing basis from good to great. And that's a dynamic, ongoing function. And I don't believe that any of us ever arrive at sort of that pinnacle, as Jim Collins calls it, the level 5 leadership, that is in a sense at an end of our leadership experience. It's more an ongoing dynamic. And in seeing that and learning about great leaders that had developed both within companies and other places, but I'm going to focus today entirely on companies because that's where our focus and our energy is largely given to organizations that want to improve their board and the relationship between the board and management. And so I saw that there was a missing piece. A professor friend of mine at Harvard, Jay Lorsch, it indicated that really boards were underperforming in the thousands, 2000 through 2010. And when you see something that's underperforming, it also means there's an opportunity of some sort.
Sure.
And so I thought maybe there's an opportunity for a business here and to be able to, since double down on my desire to see great leadership advanced and to be a part of assessing what does, how do we determine what board effectiveness is and how do we better delineate and define this notion of board effectiveness. It's a word that it's a phrase that's used often, and particularly the word effectiveness, but it wasn't well defined before, and even governance was less defined. This is something that's happened in the last 4 or 5 years to a much greater degree. And so that really was the catalyst to get the Center for Board Excellence going. And what we found, I'll just fast forward for you and your listeners, that it is something that is highly desirable by many board members and board leaders. And it was a missing link in our global society of business and board leaders.
So talk to me a little bit about the effectiveness side. You know, I think there's probably, and you've probably run into that, there's probably a lot of viewpoints around that, but kind of as an organization working with boards and CEOs, how would you define kind of on a high level what an effective board looks like?
I look at it both for the group and for the individual. What we focus in on are five key attributes: the intellectual, the emotional, the spiritual, the innovative, and the relational. And I'll go through those quickly. The intellectual has to do with those elements of knowing the business, knowing the science, how to read a balance sheet. And I'm describing, if you're a board member or a leader, the things that you want to develop is the ability to, whatever your area of strength is, to build upon that in the area of the intellectual so that you can understand risk better, can understand finance better. How does your product differentiate itself in the marketplace? What difference does it make to the end users, whoever that is, to the stakeholders, and ultimately to your shareholders also? They're a key part of the stakeholder group. If I use the word stakeholder, I don't want anyone out there to think I'm negating at all the shareholder and return on investment, because I strongly believe in a capitalism for more people than for less. I'm not going to mitigate the need for expanded capitalism. We just need to do it in a more effective way. And therefore, the other areas that are key, the emotional has to do with how we present ourselves and how we read others. What is our self-awareness level when we go into a given situation? If you're in sales, if you're working in an office environment where you're interacting with others, how are you coming across to the other people? And there's great resources out there like Strength Finders and DISC and Myers-Briggs and all these kinds of things that I think are terrific, frankly. And we study those here in our psychometrics at CBE. And then the spiritual, I want to emphasize to people, regardless of your religious viewpoint, we all believe in something. I loved a concert I went to years ago, Bob Dylan, before he would light up a song. Before he lit up the song, he said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And I think that if you don't believe in something, then you've got confusion in your life. So, but it really comes down to, what are the core values of your company? And what does your company represent in the marketplace? And then we're all in the innovation business today, in one way or another. Here we are at CBE. We are a technology company first and foremost. What we introduced in 2010 was a technology by which people could use to assess the quality of their board effectiveness and their relationship with management. And the last of that, how all this comes together in a relationology. I have a friend in England named Matt Bird. He has a company called relationology.co.uk. I thought that was such a terrific idea to come up with about the relation. Nobody had ever used this term before, which amazed me, that the relationology of an organization. Studying the organization, how do the people all relate together, which goes straight to this notion of culture. And then something I want us to get into is, why does culture eat strategy? One of the famous Peter Drucker quotes.
Right.
And so that's the approach that we have and have found to be very successful and desirable by boards, to really understand how they relate to one another in these five areas.
All right. So let's jump into that the topic that you raised regarding that culture eats strategy. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts around that as you've worked with companies.
Well, I think that what I've observed, and much of this, I'm in the fortunate position to be observing companies. We work with companies from Fortune 20 level companies up all the way through not-for-profit organizations. Because mm-hmm. we look at board members, hopefully, when they walk into the boardroom or when they pick up their board book and are reading it, that they're doing it with the same mission and intent, regardless of if it's a Fortune 100 company or if it's a not-for-profit in the local community, that there's a similar mission-driven element to that. And so within that, you have a tone within a company or a culture. And it's kind of like the air we breathe. And if that air is toxic, it really doesn't matter how good your strategy is. It will eventually destroy the organization. If we look at what Uber did, Uber saw the potential for a toxic culture forming, and they corrected it very quickly. And now apparently there's an improving culture. You know, we all get off our rails a little bit here or there, and they were losing their way a bit, but it's good to see companies correct their behavior and move forward. So I, on another current one, we would all hope, I hope that Elon Musk is a huge winner. But if he were listening to this podcast, I'd say, Elon, please get with your board if you're not already, and talk with them and ask them questions about mentorship and how you can be the most effective and win for all of us in civilization. I mean, the guy's brilliant and doing hopefully great things, but he did some things there for a while that are questioned. Fortunately, I haven't heard as much from that. And those are just large examples of how I think a culture could be injured very rapidly if the leadership isn't taking note of how that affects the lives of all stakeholders.
So you mentioned the idea that culture eats strategy. That strategy is important for a company. How does that play as far as kind of, and how is strategy misunderstood?
That strategy is how you are different. Mm-hmm. What makes our product special? And why does somebody want that product? And why should it grow? And answering those questions, I think, are key to the orientation of what is strategic and what is strategy. And if the culture is not supporting the notion of that growth, if we eventually find out today, I mean, one of the great differentiators today of holding culture accountable is social media. Mm-hmm. So we have things like Glassdoor, and we even have, you can even read things on Facebook or Twitter about a company. And I mean, we want to be careful because there can always be a disgruntled person who just has an axe to grind that is possibly even wrong in their assessment of a situation. But if I went to Glassdoor and I read 500 descriptions of the culture of a company that were all similarly consistent, that express concern about what was going on, I think we generally would recognize that there's probably a problem in that company. And if they haven't started addressing it already, then I think that culture is going to eat that strategy, no matter how successful it is. And, you know, they may sell the company because they can't fix the culture, and the buyer may be the fixer. But they'll probably sell it for 2% or 50% of the actual value of the company, assuming it was a very popular product. I mean, I'm kind of looking at it how how great products fail toxically. I mean, American Apparel was an example of that several years ago. They ended up having they were on almost every street corner in some of the large cities of America. And now you can't find one because of a toxic culture.
Interesting. So talking about, you know, a company has a strategy to acquire, you know, customers. But, you know, that whole idea, as far as, I think there are some companies that go after each customer thinking that they're equal, but sometimes compromise their overall mission. Talk about that as far as kind of the customer acquisition and the importance of picking, focusing on the right customers.
This is a area where I try to spend a lot of time learning, and that is in the area of customer selection. Naturally, in our business, if somebody came to us and wanted us to help them fix some element of their board, we would want to partner with them and help in that area. But if they want us to sort of check the box so they can look like they've got a good housekeeping seal on the door, but inside the building is toxicity, then we want to be careful to learn and discern what is a great product. And in our area, the great product is a partnership with a board that does desire excellent leadership and an excellent culture in their organization. So customer selection, I think, though, in any business is key. And I would, even down through a not-for-profit organization, I would suggest you want to be careful who you select as a customer and who you desire as a donor, because there could be unintended consequences come along with that customer. And so I think the customer selection process is one that should be thought through a series of questions at the leadership level. Who are we really trying to serve? How do we do it most effectively? And are there customers, are there unintended consequences that we could encounter through a customer relationship that would be undesirable for the long-term benefit of the organization?
That's an interesting point. I think everybody looks at, especially in the nonprofit world, you get a donor and you want all the donors you can get, but I think you're right. You can definitely compromise your values depending on who that donor, major donor is. So talk to me about some advice that you would give to, there's some new executives, leaders that are maybe in their first CEO role. They've not been in that position to work with a board. What advice would you give a new executive?
So in going back through the five items I listed before, it's initiate a relationship with the board chair or some sort of lead position on the board. If it's a small private company, the CEO and chair could quite likely be the same person. Mm-hmm. But think of the board as a partner and even as a peer mentor type relationship. I would hope that a board in a private environment would have that kind of trusted advisor. And are you willing to really hear what they have to say about the accountability structure of the organization? Because as a CEO demonstrates their ability to be accountable, the organization is going to sense some of this culturally down through the organization and have a similar approach to accountability. I think that to use the term interestingly, that could be toxic in a positive manner, or it could be viral is the better term that we use today. In a viral manner, the notion of being accountable for excellence in an organization is set as a tone from the top. So if the somehow, without inappropriately disclosing too much, because there's decorum and there's a balance of how much we disclose and all we do in our relationships with others, that the relationship between the CEO and sometimes between a few members of the management team and the board is key for all the stakeholders to have a sense they're doing their job well. They care about what we care about. And hopefully that's great product, profitability, success, and a great stakeholder customer relationship. And so I think that one of the areas that we often ask the question, if you were charged with being a coach or mentor in a given situation, say with a fellow board member or between a chair and a CEO, how would you coach this person to improve professionally over the next year? I think that's a good question, whether or not we are, shift back to the notion of Jim Collins, good to great. The differentiator was strength of will and humility. And I think the humility function is volunteering to be accountable. I don't think one is accountable unless they volunteer to be that way. And I think that really shows a tremendous strength of character for someone to invite accountability.
What advice would you give that person kind of moving into more of a tension-filled environment?
Well, that's going to be a challenge. I would also, realistically, if this is in most business and even some not-for-profit environments, you want to have some sort of legal resource. And when I say that, someone with legal experience is usually in any business or not-for-profit area, there's usually a friend or a lawyer that's nearby that depending on the exact situation, you may need to retain this person more as a consultant than as a quote lawyer, right? And get good legal advice on how to proceed. And when I say good legal advice on how to proceed, I have in my set of relationships, I have several lawyers who provide professional advice to me and to us that are being paid to do that in some way. But it's not so much lawyering as it is good justice advice, I might call it. What is a just way to deal with a contentious situation? And how do we resolve this with the least amount of damage to the organization? And we find settlements or relationship building exercises in which we mitigate the risk, because the situation you're describing, let's assume for a minute there's no, Shangri-La kind of outcome. This right. isn't everybody's not going to be happy in the end. So it's getting to a resolution that is acceptable for all parties. Probably at every business school in any environment, but we spent a lot of time at Harvard talking about our ZOPA, the zone of possible agreement, and then your BATNA. If people want to look it up online, it's a great tool to figure out where do you walk away or how do you find ways for sufficient consensus, right, and negotiation to where there's an area of possible agreement, mm-hmm, to limit the walk away point. And so there's the BATNA and the ZOPA. The BATNA, best alternative to a negotiated agreement, and or close to that, and then the ZOPA. So if you're listening to this and you've never heard those two terms, just Google them and study that a little bit. It's a great tool to have in your back pocket at any given moment in a negotiation.
Interesting. But I know you do work outside the U.S. Talk about kind of board governance, how it differs from the U.S. And I know you've worked in Europe and in mm-hmm. other parts of the world. Talk a little bit about that, what you've seen.
Well, it's very interesting today because the United States, we tend to have a system that evolves more. And what I mean by that, it can be legal precedents. In our country, the Delaware Court of Chancery, because a lot of corporations are formed in Delaware for the tax and corporate formation purposes, it's become almost like a tradition in this country. And under the Court of Chancery, there are essentially three, and these extend to any board member. And these come out of a historical point is 1992. And a thing called the Cadbury Report out of the United Kingdom. But at the same time, there were things going on in this country. Bill George, who's now a professor at Harvard, was also initiating activities at Medtronic. and other companies were doing this kind of thing about what are the duties of a board, and it's duty of care, duty of monitoring or oversight, and duty of loyalty. And there's varying other descriptions, but it really comes down to those three. And I think the first one is fascinating to me. And if you're interested, if someone's interested listening, we wrote a short piece, but I think I hope it's pretty good on the duty of care, because it's a fascinating word. The notion of care. I mean, think about how much a mother cares for her child. Well, it's similar to the way a board member should care for its organization. I mean, there is a familial type of relationship between the leadership of an organization and an organization. I mean, many of the businesses in the world today are started by families, right? Mother or father or group. And therefore, it's interesting, globally, there is a similar, and I use that metaphor because there is a similar context in many of the larger countries of the world. And even China is evolving a bit this direction towards focusing on this responsibility to, one, support those three duties and define those well. And then, interestingly enough, this started in simultaneous. We had started the Center for Board Excellence, and there was no one mandated a board assessment. In late 2010, the United Kingdom Corporate Governance Code was released, and it mandated a board assessment at least every 3 years to be conducted by an outside party. Now, Stock Exchange listing, your agreement to be on the New York Stock Exchange, and the UK Corporate Governance Code required some sort of board assessment, but usually that was kind of like an end of the session, quick, you'd fill it out on one page piece of paper. It wasn't what we consider today to be an assessment of the board, the board's culture, the mission and values, and those three duties that we're talking about. It's much more intensively focused today on how do we assess good corporate governance. And that's being done similarly globally. So the countries, particularly that the EU, for the most part, is following out of the Cadbury report in 92, many of the countries, United Kingdom, Scandinavian countries, and what's evolved out of that is the UK, Australia, Canada, and South Africa, all because of their British influence, had followed the Cadbury Court report and the UK code, which was first came out in the early 2000s. And the world now, today, is following a similar set of examples, and there are other organizations now that have formed over the last several years, some under the UN and so on, that are encouraging a more global approach to the code of conduct for boards of directors. So it's becoming more common. And then that is drifting over to and being augmented in the private world of because a lot of larger private companies say, I don't really want to go public because of all the hassle. Right. But I want to behave well. And what does well look like? And what does well mean? And that's where companies like ourselves are trying to help augment that definition.
Okay. So you've had an interesting seat, seeing a lot of different organizations and seen a number of leaders that you've observed over the last several years. Looking back on what you've learned in your career, if you're able to go back to a 22-year-old Byron, what advice would you give him in your career from what you've observed?
What inspires you will probably encourage your career more than the noise around that inspiration. And noise can be money, noise can be popularity, you will eventually achieve some of those if that's your career desire. And I can even, let me make it a local, simple example. I'm in Greensboro, North Carolina, and for example, here, a home builder who does a great job, I can think of a few who started out quite simply, and they focused on the core elements. And I would say, going back to even the duty concept, they cared a lot. They were monitored. They allowed and invited monitoring or oversight by their customers, and they were loyal to their customer base. And today, they are very successful. And some of them, if we follow that in other areas and in other businesses, I think we could find examples where people that have done that sort of thing have grown businesses to massive sizes and have solved big problems in the world in an excellent way. And it started with somebody being determined to fulfill that vision that they had for their lives. And that can be a great carpenter on a local basis, or it can be developing a pharmaceutical or a device, or in the case of someone like Elon Musk, figuring out how to solve transportation issues so that it doesn't cause massive problems and congestion in our world, both from a environmental standpoint and from a logistical standpoint.
That's good. Well, if you look back on your career, the importance of mentors and what you've seen with other CEOs, how important is for somebody that's kind of starting out or earlier in their career to have mentors around them?
I would call a mentor an imperative. I've been involved with probably five key mentors in my life, and right off the bat, I can unfortunately a few have died, which is always sad. But there's one gentleman that I'm involved with today, who I knew at 15. And I'm involved in an organization that's a leadership organization that he founded today, and doing very interesting things in the world. And I wouldn't be where I am today without those mentors. And my accountability to my vision for life and helping others would not be where it is today without those mentors. And I don't think I would be happy without those mentors. They're reminders. They're that positive voices that I hear in my head, particularly when I'm down or feel like circumstances are difficult. I hear mentors in my life say, you can stick in there. You can overcome this. And I think that's an important thing, to have those kinds of voices, because too many times I think that all of us would resonate. We've got some sort of negative voice telling us why we can't do it. Right. We need to overcome those. And that's a key part of leadership.
So tell me about just some of the influences outside of mentors, books that you've read that maybe recently or in the past that you would say would be really helpful for a CEO or a board member to read.
Well, a few that I find that I would put on the top, almost imperative or required reading list would be Good to Great is an excellent read. I think he released that in 2005. There's a book by Cynthia Montgomery named The Strategist. It's relatively short and pretty quick read. If you're a private company or a family company, then I would suggest Generation to Generation by John Davis, a very good book and a professor of mine at one point. A couple books that Jay Lorsch has written on board. He is a specific board expert, and he wrote one, Back to the Drawing Board, that I would recommend. That leans a little bit more towards the larger public company arena, but it's a good read. And then Collins followed up with a book called Great by Choice. And then I'm a big fan of some of the of a few English authors, and I happen to be a big Tolkien fan. If one has ever had a hankering to read Lord of the Rings, I think there's lots of leadership and culture lessons all throughout Lord of the Rings. So if you've never read it, it's summertime. That's a good read. So those are a few that I'll throw out that are off the top of my head. I happen to be in Oxford, England last week, and I walked by a pub called the Eagle and Child, where a little group of authors named the Inklings used to gather, and they would read each other's manuscripts. And that's two of those key authors, with C.S. Lewis. I'm a big fan of some of his writings, and then also Tolkien, and the two of them and some others would gather and read their manuscripts there, which is a pretty cool thought. Not a bad idea to have like a small group that you get together with regularly and talk about ideas.
Good. So outside of work, I think it's always important when I talk to CEOs, it's always interesting to hear what they do outside of their work and the importance of having some other interests. Tell me a little bit some of your outside interests.
I am a big reader, and I enjoy study. So that's just kind of a natural part of what I spend my personal time doing. In my little office at home, I'm often in there studying away on fun parts of literature and history. Right now I'm reading Robert's book on Churchill, which is a great read. But that's a heavy read. It's about 1600 pages. You got to be a big Churchill fan to plow through that one. But right now, Mark, I am spending a lot of my extra time, because I'm delighted to have four wonderful little grandchildren all under the age of 5, and they live near me. So I hope I maintain being a youthful sort of grandpa, because I'm an active outdoors person. I ski race. In college, I was an alpine skier. And so I continue to do that. So I look forward to teaching them how to ski. And I get out and ski with friends, do a lot of hiking. My wife and I do a lot of hiking, and I think that's a great leadership activity, because it helps us experience the benefits of the world that we have around us. And I'm an outdoorsy kind of person, though. I'm game for about any kind of sport that won't quite kill me at this age, but I'll try almost anything that tests what I can do today in a sporting area. But play a little golf here and there, but I'm not particularly good. But get out more for the cultural piece, to spend an afternoon with four people from time to time is a good thing to do.
Good. Well, any parting advice that you would give somebody in leadership?
I'm working with our team. We have an ongoing suggestion period, but in our annual reviews, we particularly want members of the team to employees to put in suggestions. And one of the suggestions was to develop and focus on their strength finders. They all wanted to read strength finders. I'd started doing that on a voluntary level for all employees. I offered to them that we'll buy them a copy of strength finders, and they can take the test, and then I'll meet with them. But what they've wanted to do is a strength finder series of what we call a lunch and learn here at our office. And so they've asked me to lead that the first few times, and then to have others come in and guest speakers, but also some of the employees talk about it. So the thing I love about strength finders is the simple concept of, we can spend our lives working on our problems or our weaknesses. Where if we spend more of our time on our strengths and doing what is good, we've got less time to waste on what is error-filled or weak within us. And so I would encourage, I found it very encouraging to me to kind of rehash. I pulled out and dusted off my, when I first did Strength Finders about 9 years ago, and it was fascinating to think through the lens of teaching this in a way with my, and walking through this with my employees. And it's a humbling and yet it's also an encouraging contextual activity to look at what are you good at doing and how are you going to do it to help. And frankly, I think today we have an unusual opportunity to advance and to do more good for our civilization than ever before in the history of mankind. And kind of going back to the notion that let's all pull together and widen the prosperity base as wide as possible and change civilization together. And I think we do that by encouraging all of our strengths.
It's good. Well, I sure appreciate your insights and thoughts today, and this has been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you having a podcast like this and encouraging this sort of thing. I hope this is helpful for someone out there.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.